You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, your host, Ben Eagle. Please remember to subscribe to the show wherever you are listening. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 198 of the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. Today, we're in Devon with new entrant to farming, Adam Short, who I first met at the bar at Groundswell last year. Adam's primary professional background is in the IT sector, and indeed, his primary line of work today, alongside life on the farm, is in agri software, a subject that I'm sure will be of interest to many of you, which is partly why I've asked him on the podcast. He's had a varied career prior to moving into the agricultural community, and he moved to his small farm in Devon in 2016. He's the current registrar for the Old English Goat Society and achieved rare breed recognition for them in 2020. And alongside Kim Brook and Flavian Abiro, who of course has been on the podcast before, Adam is the co-founder of the Pig Exchange Network, which aims to fill gaps around knowledge exchange for smaller scale pig producers. Adam, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to Meet the Farmers. This is your second podcast that you've been on with me. You were on Rural Business Focus a few weeks ago. But yeah, so it's great to have it on another pod.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for having me again. Yeah, I can genuinely say always a pleasure now. No, this is the second one.
How's your week going? How's life down in Devon?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's about week six now of lambing for us, so it's basically the end, apart from a few stubborn ones. So yeah, sort of at that max sleep deprived state.
Yeah, that stage.
Yeah, we probably bode well for a podcast, but I will try and be as chipper as a normal human.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. Tell us about, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about your life growing up, first of all, because when you started your life, I assume that a life on a farm or working in the agricultural sector broadly wasn't a given.
No, it was pretty much unknown. I mean, it was a normal suburban town upbringing, countryside adjacent, you'd probably say, but I got no clue about what was going on in the countryside around me. It was, your classic sort of idle young lads going for a walk through fields and woodlands. You know, that was as far as it went. No understanding of what went on there. And I guess interspersed with maybe fairly common aspirations to be a vet at some point in childhood. Appealing until the academic requirements really hit home there. You know, I didn't really feel at any point I was on course for 2 A's and a B or 3 A's at A level. I didn't really feel like it was gonna, take off. aside from that sort of stuff, growing up was, fairly, I think, typical. Both my parents worked in fairly dissimilar jobs, neither of whom had got any connection with agriculture outside. And I think my dad did some work experience when he was 14 or 15 on a dairy farm. I only found that out, years after school, when we started doing stuff with land. So it's quite funny, really. And yeah, then sort of having, I guess, honed in on IT at some point during my schooling, then went to Aberystwyth to do software engineering.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, which is obviously fairly fairly far removed from any designs around agriculture, or at least used to be.
No, exactly. As we'll go on to see, those paths have sort of, you've managed to find a way where you've combined the two. But yes, as you say, you went to ABBA to do a degree in software engineering. You graduated, and after graduation, you went to work around Bracken, which is where you met your first farmer. Tell me more about that time of your life.
Yeah, it was actually, there was a year in industry. So it was the gap between the second and third years of the degree. So you could go out and have a real job in inverted commas for a year. And that was in Brecon. And it was pure fluke, but I ended up sitting, doing an IT role, but sitting next to a woman who owned a farm in the up in the hills, just off the Epant range. And we got chatting, and she found out I'd never been on a farm before. Yeah. Outside of, you know, casually rambling through a field I wasn't really aware of. And she invited me up to their farm. And I think at that point, I think I went up and stayed for the weekend. It was only, I don't know, about an hour from where I was working and staying, but I went up for the weekend and just absolutely fell in love with it. It was so different to everything I knew to that point that I was there then every weekend and every summer, Easter, autumn holiday thereafter, which was amazing. So, yeah, there's no other way of putting it than they really taught me most of what I knew about farming, really. It was amazing. I got involved in all sorts of jobs that you wouldn't imagine an IT student, you know, a software student was going to get roped into, but... you know, that all of the sheep work, all of the hedge laying, they've got an equine retirement yard as well. So I ended up doing a pile of horse stuff that I got no idea.
This is so random. I love it.
It really is. It's absolute chance. And it grew from there, really. So once you, once the door is sort of not really open for you, because ag's not like that. It's more complicated. But once you can sort of peek round a little bit, it then starts this thought process of, well, what how do I get into this? How can I start? And I know you've covered this theme a lot on this podcast. It's the access and the new entrant thing is really difficult. And I went through all the usual avenues, really, you know, looking for council farms, looking for tenancies, looking for small plots of land for sale that, you know, we could perhaps do some sort of guerrilla project on that ended up with a house at the end of it. Yeah. And it started a very frustrating 10 years or so thereafter, trying to figure out, you know, how do we get land and start a farm and do that stuff? I mean, it's no easier now. It's probably harder now than it was then.
Yeah, no, this is really interesting, and this is partly why I wanted to bring you on, because you've literally gone through that experience, and to actually profile this story I think is really important, because clearly it took you a long time, and there are numerous struggles right the way through, from obviously the whole money side, but also just the access side, and maybe I don't want to put words into your mouth, but maybe a sort of, how much do you feel like it's an issue being a so-called sort of outsider from the industry coming in? Do you think that played an impact, or do you think that that wasn't really too much of an issue?
I mean, it's one of those where at the time I definitely felt like that was an issue. It was very much, if not a farmer, then it would be not a proper farmer, in inverted commas, you know. And I think that stigma still exists. I think if you've got, you know, less than 300 acres and less than 1,000 sheep, you're not, in inverted commas, a proper farmer. But what I've learned, I guess, more recently is that if you can find the right, essentially the right crowd, I mean, you might call it a support network nowadays, but there is a whole bunch of people who will really, really vociferously help with that sort of stuff, and I really not like that. But I don't think I really meshed into that crowd until quite recently. Renting a field even is quite difficult. You know, there's no sort of meritocratic element to it, and it's not even a particularly free market type system. If there's a block of land that's coming up for rent, it's probably already been agreed down the mart who is going to rent that for the year, you know. And you don't have access to that community as you wouldn't as a new entrant. You really don't get a look in. So, I mean, my first opportunity was entirely fluke, involved sitting next to somebody at a new workplace, this time up in Leicestershire. I hadn't realised this was a pattern until now.
Yeah, you definitely sit next to the right people, clearly.
That's what it is. I should write a book, How to Sit Next to the Right People. And this, it was a lady again, and she had 8 acres in the middle of Leicestershire that she didn't know what to do with. And I just said one day, I'll rent it off you. And it was dirt cheap because it flooded for part of the year, and it got a rail line running between it, between the two halves of it. But it was great. So yeah, I think this was about 2004-ish. So rented 8 acres and went and bought some sheep, which is, you know, it's a fairly odd thing to do for someone with a full-time IT job. But
I mean,
but
maybe,
exactly. Sort of dive in,
and I feel, I mean, this is partly what I love about your story, because I mean we're going to be sort of flip-flopping between the IT side and the farming side, but I like how it sort of webs right the way through. So let's turn back a little bit to the IT. I mean, how long have you been working in IT, and give us a flavor of your career, because it has been quite broad.
It has, yeah. So I mean, as I said, it was a software degree that I did at Aberystwyth, software engineering. But I mean, basically what that taught me, apart from, you know, some useful skills in the discipline, was that I don't want to do software. it was all right, but I didn't enjoy it by the end of the final year. But I had done a lot of networking and infrastructure stuff during that degree. Some of this might get a bit technical, so just call me out if I go a bit too IT jargon, but The software disciplines are sort of, they're divided up quite nicely, and you've got sort of actual coding, which is normally called dev now, development, over on one side. You've got the software stuff, so that's installing, configuring, and managing applications that sits in the middle. And then you've got the hardware stuff, so servers and networks, basically all the, what we call them, bits of tin. That's the okay. Legal. In the IT world, but
that's the technical term.
That's it, tin and string. So yeah, I was into tin and string. It's all the bits of physical kit and the wires to join them together. And that I quickly found I enjoyed that more. And it was more of a niche, again, more or less accidental, but fewer people get involved in that sort of the networking side of things, so network engineering and networking design, then get involved in the other areas of IT as a general principle. So a bit less competition, bit easier to guarantee yourself some future work. That was what I found. Yeah. So I worked at a few places sort of on the run up, and IT is always sold as this route to financial stability, if not riches, isn't it? And it's just not true for so much of it. You know, I worked in, you know, 20 to 30K jobs for years with no route out of them, you know, and part of that's location, you know, up in the Midlands. It certainly back then, I know Birmingham's had a bit of a boom, Leicester's had a bit of a boom since then, but in those sorts of areas, there are lots of naff IT jobs. You know, it's not a route to riches. It's really not, but I mean, perhaps more stable and more sanity preserving than, you know, some farming roles, I can imagine. So yeah, I jumped about a little bit, and then I accidentally, again, I use that word a lot, I've realised, fell into IT contracting, so freelance IT. And there's no great mystery or secrets around it anymore. There's been lots of stuff in the news about freelancers in journalism and, you know, across the BBC and all that stuff. And the IT sector is the same, as, you know, 40% of the workforce perhaps at times is self-employed.
Yeah, I thought that was probably the case.
Yeah, it's really taken off. I mean, around, I don't know, maybe sort of 2005 to 2010, it just sort of exploded. You know, it went from hundreds of thousands of people involved to millions of people involved in that. Yeah. That particular bit of the industry, and that really does pay well. You know, there's no two ways about it. That is what people talk about when they are talking about the financial gains to be had in IT as an individual worker anyway. So that really, whilst I wasn't targeting that route at any point, that it became obvious to me that was probably my way into getting some land and getting on the farming ladder at some point.
Yeah.
There is no way on a £25,000 a year IT job that I was ever going to save enough money to buy a farm or a small holding or anything like that. It just wasn't. Not before I was 60 anyway, you know.
Yes.
At that point, I don't know if I'd have had it in me by the time I was 60 to start all of this stuff.
This episode is being supported by our primary sponsor, A-Plan Rural. Why did I want to collaborate with A-Plan Rural? Well, having got to know them, their team shares my passion for giving a voice to farmers, and we are both driven to raise the profile of farming voices to a wider audience, so it seemed quite a good fit. Quite frankly, together we will be able to do a lot more. A-Plan Rural do a lot of work on social media themselves, sharing farming accounts and farming stories. They have a rural community blog which shares farmers' experiences, and they also support a growing number of initiatives that champion UK farmers, including this podcast. So a big thank you to A-Plan Rural for supporting Meet the Farmers.
Yeah, so I basically spent best part of 10 years dodging up and down the M4 corridor, then doing IT freelance work. And that it was much more enjoyable as well. I found I had to keep changing what I was doing, still within the same discipline, but if I could switch which project I was on and who I was working for and all that stuff every 12 months, 18 months, I was much more engaged that way. So I enjoyed the job a lot more. You know, it was starting to get boring sitting at a desk doing the same thing. You know, it's a fairly well-established trope, but yeah, you could very easily, you know, just find yourself at a desk, the same desk job for 10 years and you know, slowly go mad. And I would definitely have been prone to that. But yeah, I found the IT contracting side much, much more interesting because you would have that variety. Yeah, and worked for a lot of interesting places. I started down at the hydrographic office down in Taunton. That was my first contracting role. And then went to IBM and did some exciting things there. I've worked for various policing organizations, worked for the Home Office, for the Ministry of Defence. Yeah, lots of fairly random, fairly broad companies and private sector stuff in there as well.
Yeah. So you've got these 8 acres in Leicestershire with the railway line running through it. This is sort of the beginning of your farming career, is it? I'm going to call it that. Where how does this work alongside everything else, and where do you go next?
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, if you'd have asked me if I was going to do it that way now, I'd say no, that's ridiculous. You know, it's how would you have 8 acres of rented land that is not in the same location and a full-time job? I mean, really, you just sacrifice everything else. So you have no free time. That's what I've learned through it all. You know, if you can accept that you've got no hobbies and no weekends, you can do it. You can have a full-time job and you can run a small animal concern, you know, production focused. Very, very difficult at lambing time, obviously, because you know, checks every, 4 hours at least. That gets tricky. But if there's two of you and you've got a bit of flex in work patterns, it's just about achievable. So we started with 8 acres and we actually ended up with 30 plus pretty quickly. Once people found out what we were doing in the local area, and once we were able to tap into that community a bit more, we were able to, you know, negotiate extra bits of land or people would then eventually start offering bits to us. But it's very much a catch-22, and you know, you've got to have the first bit of land to be offered the next bit of land, you know.
That's interesting.
That was what we found anyway. So we got up to about 100 ewes pretty quickly, and we were selling direct to the public, you know, box lamb. Without enough of a plan, I'm going to say. I mean, it was all about doing it rather than, you know, thinking about the why we were doing it. I think at that point, we knew that was what we wanted to do, and I'd known since this time at university that was the direction I wanted to follow, and I wasn't quite sure how I'd make it happen. So we just kind of started in the hope that then things would snowball from there. You know, if you start sheep farming, you start acquiring land, it'll come together at some point. And that didn't work. And what we found was that we could have gone further into it. We could have, you know, sacrificed more time and jobs probably would have been jeopardized and had to have been changed to fit around it at some point. But it would have been very hard to build a truly profitable business that way, we found. It it was profitable as long as we didn't pay ourselves, you know, but that's, which, yeah, I mean, might be a sector-wide problem. Yeah.
I think so. There was a really interesting conversation going on Twitter yesterday on that very subject.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, we've kind of got a similar thing now. We can talk about that later, but yeah, it was difficult. So a point came, it was perhaps about 2009-ish, where, well, actually, I mean, to be honest, there was a little bit of a mental breakdown that went on at this point. And it's, you know, I don't want to take them down too far, but yeah, something really broke.
Just pausing on that. That's reality, isn't it? It's just when it happens.
Well, it was, and it goes back to that. It is too much, really. You know, there's a lot of machismo about the stuff in the industry, isn't there? You know, if you work harder and harder, you'll achieve more. And I mean, if we're kind of doing it now with everything we're trying to do right now, but at least now I know I can only dedicate, you know, 12 months to some insane working patterns, and then it either has to have paid off or we stop doing it, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's not sustainable, but I hadn't learned that lesson back then. So, yeah, pretty much had a proper breakdown. Sort of 2008, 2009. Thought, okay, I'll go and work for somebody else. And I've got no idea how this came about, but I went to a bunch of farm interviews for farm manager roles, which is the most preposterous thing. Now, when I look back on it, I got some experience. You know, I got my experience from the training ground in Wales, and we'd run our own operation for a bit. But I mean, you know, compared to what I know now, I knew nothing back then. But anyway, I got a farm manager job on one farm and lasted about a month. And then.
Oh, really?
Yeah, quit that because it was too, I might get stick for this, but it was too sort of factory like. I'm not using the factory farming stick there. It was just factory like. Having decided I didn't fancy that after 4 weeks of doing it. I got headhunted by another farm for a livestock manager role, believe it or not. It was all a bizarre series of events and a bizarre time. So I went to work there. Again, that was sort of a couple of months in, and it all sort of fell apart for a variety of reasons. But, you know, I can look back on it now and see that for what it was. You know, that was a proper sort of mental aberration. You know, that was a breakdown and depression and all that sort of stuff really coming out, you know, all over the place. So it was interesting. So I call that my sort of midlife crisis at 28 or something, which doesn't bode well for my life expectancy, but there we are. That's
bizarrely, I went through a very similar stage when I was like 27, 28. So
yeah, I think it is a thing. I know so many people who hit that. And obviously there's the 27 club famously, you know, with Hendrix and all that. I think it is a momentous period in life somehow. I know nothing more about it than that, but it definitely seems to be a thing. Yeah, so a lot of those things didn't work out, and I sort of gathered myself up a bit, I suppose, and went back to IT proper. And you know, not for good money, and not into the contracting thing straight away. Back to the normal run of the mill, having done a bit of the midlife crisis thing, you know. Or whatever it was. And yeah, was really none the wiser for how to get into the industry. That, you know, the renting and building our own stock up hadn't worked really very well, or didn't seem to be an obvious route to it. Working for somebody else was no better, you know, certainly not at that time in the state I was in. So yeah, was a bit lost really for a few years. And then, yeah, as I say, I accidentally hit into this IT contracting malarkey. And then finally I could see a route, but it was only because of, what I'd probably call a disproportionate earning level, really, compared with, you know, peers of the same age. But that then seemed like the obvious way in. You know, if we saved hard for, 8 to 10 years, we could afford the deposit on a small holding or a bit of land that was viable enough to build a house on eventually, you know. So, yeah, that was what we did. So sort of, 2008 to 2016, more or less, was that period, really. And as I mentioned, dotted up and down the M4 corridor during that time, and looked for small holdings, small farms, still keeping an eye out for council farms, but obviously they're rare as hen's teeth. And you know, we I guess we found we'd even missed the boat on the, you know, the large small holding small farm thing to a greater or lesser degree. You know, so much of that had happened in the 90s, early noughties, and they'd been carved up and split into two, and then those had been split into two, and you know, you were left with a lot of properties in the countryside which had a 2-acre garden essentially, or a 1-acre garden and a 1-acre pony paddock, you know, and that's that is the recipe in the property market, and clearly that's what everybody wants, and it's maddening, it's so frustrating, and we see it going on all around us now where we are. You know, if anything comes up with some land on it, some bugger will come in and carve it in two. And, you know, it's half as viable as it once was, if it was viable. But we lucked out, really, having looked at lots of, I mean, really, things that would struggle to be productive, even with a decent acreage, because of where they were, you know, the bottom of dark valleys or on floodplains or, you know, the top of a moor. We found 26 acres just outside of Tiverton with a house that it had been lived in but hadn't been touched since it was built in 1956. So, the people who wanted to move in to a decent house and have a pony were put off because it was a full renovation project. And the people who didn't mind a house renovation project were put off by the massive amount of land in comparison. Right. You know, it wasn't just a pony paddock or two. Yeah. And we were just lucky, really, that the sellers were holding out to sell the whole thing as a package, because our neighbouring sheep farmer would have bought the big bulk of land off them.
Okay.
Had he been able to, and we wouldn't begrudge him that. But it's, we very much lucked out with that. That very nearly didn't happen. So, 2016, we found ourselves with an actual house, which was just about livable, albeit it was from the olden days. And 26 acres that we all of a sudden had to do something with.
And then take me to the next stage of the story, really. So that first year in Devon, and also how you started what you're doing down there now, how that all developed.
Yeah, so I guess we wanted to continue something similar to the recipe that we'd found was working when we were in Leicestershire, when we were renting the ground. We knew that direct meat sales of boxed lamb worked pretty well. It was pretty easy to do in a sense, as long as you'd got the local Enviro Health to sign off your delivery vehicle, and if you were straight from abattoir to customer within a couple of hours. It's all pretty simple to do. So we knew that would work. So sheep were straight in. They were the first things that we got after fencing, because of course that was the other detail I missed about this luxurious property, was there was not an ounce of fencing on the entire place.
Wow, right.
For the last, I think, 50 years, it had just been taken for a late crop of hay, which was brilliant for the sort of native wildflower meadow aspect and all that stuff, because it just had nutrients taken and taken and taken, and stuff had been able to flower and all that sort of stuff, but no infrastructure, just nothing. So we were really starting from scratch. On the land as well as with the house refurb. Fence the first field, got the sheep, and just kept trying to keep momentum ahead of the grazing requirement, basically, from that point. And, as soon as you've got animals, it gets very complicated, doesn't it? Yeah, we then got, you know, a mix of priorities all of a sudden. We've still both got full-time day jobs at this point. We have to do up the house because it has things like a 50 electric water pump that you turn on for 8 minutes until the water overflows out the roof, and then you turn it off again. And it's all sorts of basically everything needs doing, everything at this point. But, you know, it was really our only viable way in. So we just had to get on with it. And we've bought, what do we buy? Maybe 30 breeding ewes and a tup. And, you know, true to the old adage that when you buy stock in a march, you're buying something that somebody else didn't want. You know, you're not buying the grade A breeding ewes because the farmer kept those for themselves. You know, if you do well, you're getting the grade Bs. So you know, starting the process of really tuning those up and breeding out some of the problems. So many of them had foot problems in the early days. So we spent a long time on that. I mean, I could talk for an hour just on the, you know, the breeding improvements with the sheep, but it's, you know, it's only 30 ewes. It's a tiny consideration really, but yeah, so much had to go into them as well as everything else. And then it was, it must've been the following year. So 2017, we'd been talking about having some sort of dairy capability of some sort, if only for the house, you know, just in a sort of self-sufficient way to provide milk for the house, but hopefully to do, you know, some sort of, you know, artisan raw milk at the farm gate or artisan cheese or something along those lines. We started looking at goats. Neither of us really fancied cattle just because of the scale of them. You know, I can just about win an argument with a sheep. I don't think I could. I don't think I could with a cow. Well, I know I couldn't. You know, those couple of previous farm jobs taught me I didn't win any arguments with cattle. I'd never really been attracted to them. So we started looking at goats, but so much of the data is hidden. And I think that's true pretty much across the board with agriculture. So if you want to find out about the performance of a breed of goat versus another breed of goat, let's say, it's quite difficult. It's getting easier, I suppose, but all you hear about are the big successes, the big show wins, you know, the people advertising that they've got a premium dairy goat that produced 8 kilos of liquid milk per day. And if we wanted that much milk, we'd get a cow, you know, that's too much. So we could find out that information and we could look at the dairy breeds in inverted commas, but we couldn't find much else out. So we sort of went on this mission to find a more modest yielding goat, really found a very small amount of information out there. But what there was a couple of web pages referencing the Old English goat. And we'd never heard about this goat before. Then there was the confusion between, there's actually two breeds we then discovered, the English goat and the Old English goat. And what's the difference between those? And of course, nobody wants to tell you the difference because, you know, they're in competition with each other and it gets really straight away. It was amazing. It was so confusing just to come at that as essentially as a consumer to say, you know, which one of these things am I going to buy? And you've got no information to determine which one's going to be best for you. So anyway, we tuck the punt and we got involved with the Old English goats. We liked the sort of what I say the messaging behind it. There was barely any messaging behind it really at that point, but there was basically the link to the pre-1880s goats that used to be all around the UK. That is the Old English goat.
Okay,
that was basically the messaging. And the English goat is a somewhat improved version of that, so improved probably, but has Swiss and Nubian blood in it to improve the milk yield and the performance of it. So it's lost some of the hardy characteristics. So is a bit less hardy and a bit less low input. That was basically the line that we could draw. So we got in touch with the Old English Goat Society, and no goats available because they are desperately rare and they're kept by about 12 people across the country, you know.
Right.
So we got a bit more involved. We went up to the AGM up north and we managed to, through a few different contacts, we managed to eventually get hold of some goats, started breeding them. And then within a year or two, I'd landed the registrar job because I was one of two people who understood the database. And I mean, like so many of the breed societies, it's a group of enthusiastic volunteers, many of whom are rapidly aging past the point of them wanting to do that sort of stuff. So we kind of, I don't know if we hit the society at the right point or the wrong point, but, you know, we were by far the youngest people to be involved at that point. And there was a bunch of people who were very happy to pass the baton on. So, yeah, we got then, you know, more stuck in every year that went by. And I think it was 2018. I took over as the registrar, and then really set about just trying to improve their lot with the biggest impact that I possibly could. And the RBST recognition, the Rare Breed Survival Trust recognition, had been a subject of discussion for at least 20 years that I knew of. So yeah, we started building the case then from 2018 onwards, and And so much of it was basically just down to the data. You know, how much data did you have? Could you prove X, and did you have records back to Y? You know, that, they were the primary considerations. And then after that, there's a lot of woolly opinion-based stuff as well that you have to sort of navigate.
Let's turn towards pigs. Tell us about the Pig Exchange Network, what it is and why you started it along with Tina Flavian.
Yeah, so that I guess we had some similar concerns or priorities when we started looking into pigs as when we were looking at goats. You know, how do we find out how one breed compares with another, and what are the production properties and the feed requirements and all the rest of it of one breed compared to another? And that's before we get into the consumer end, you know, the fat ratios and the flavor and all that stuff. And the, you know, the data just doesn't exist again. Or if it does, it's guarded and not shared, you know. And that was a fair old frustration with the pigs. But we dived in as was, and we had a little cast around the breeds. We kept fattened weaners before, so we knew a bit. But diving into the breeding, we wanted to pick one single pure breed, something that was viable in terms of production, but something that needed help as well in terms of its popularity. So we settled on the middle white. It's not a coloured pig, so it doesn't have the attraction of something like the Oxford Sandian Black or the Gloucester Old Spot. It's got quite low numbers nationally for no particularly good reason, but was the London porker, you know, is a properly commercially viable pig. And that turned out to be the right move, really. They're a very, very nice pig. They're pretty well natured. They do well outside. They're not mad rooters like things like the Berkshires and the Tamworths have a bit of a rep for really rooting ground up. But they still basically have the same input requirements as all pigs do. You know, there's an old recipe about a pound of food per pig per day per month it's been alive. And that's basically true for all of them. You might juggle it up and down a couple of hundred grams, depending on how much fat you want on the pig, but not much really. So having got some middle white pigs and started breeding them, we'd done all of the numbers. We knew where we needed to be on production to be profitable with the pigs, and it looked good. And until we got to the practicalities of the genetics of what was available, and all we could find was show pigs. I mean, really, there's just the British Pig Association as the major organization to look after these animals, and they're really focused on showing. And showing animals is great and is an important way of, you know, engaging with a certain subsection of the public and promoting pigs in that sense. But it's really only a small sliver of what's required. And we seem to have almost whittled down most of our native pig breed population down to those show-winning pigs and that show-winning genetics, stuff that's tuned to that. And it's of absolutely no use to somebody who wants to start up with an outdoor pig operation doing, you know, pastured pigs or some sort of more sustainable monogastric production, which is what we all need to be pushing now. And the customers, you know, really, really are keen for it. So, yeah, very quickly we found we'd got pigs that were having very small litter sizes. There was a huge variability in growth rates, even given the same environmental conditions, same feed, all of that stuff. And health problems, particularly foot problems. You know, we've got very, very big pigs on very, very light feet because that's what had been bred for the show ring. So we really struggled to find a way to help ourselves with that. And that's when we got talking with Kim Brooke and with Flavian about similar issues that they found. It quickly becomes apparent that this is a sector-wide problem. You know, there isn't a lot of information really about any of the native and rarer breeds when it comes to the production properties of them. You know, there's just not a lot of information out there. But particularly with pigs and the challenges that the entire pig industry has had over the last couple of years, the native and rarer breeds have suffered probably even worse, you know. And over the last 20 years, I think there's only two breeds, two of our native breeds that have not declined over the last 20 years. Wow. And I think, that, yeah, it's The British LOPs have seen an increase because they are self-managed. They're not BPA managed. So they've got their own organisation, and they've had a really big push, particularly down here in the southwest, on the popularity of the LOP and the Oxford Sandian Black, which is obviously a very colourful and attractive pig, and kind of is the darling pig of the smallholder. You know, so those two have seen a small increase in population. Everything else has declined. Every other native breed has declined over the last 20 years. And that's terrible. But I think it's multifactored, of course, but I think a lot of it has been the focus on the key organizations to just showing, you know. I think if you just focus on showing in one particular area of outreach, I think you've narrowed your options so much that, you know, if we get a pivot in production type or values or what the consumer wants from these smaller producers, you know, we're not able to adapt to that very easily. Kim and Flavian and I discussed this at length for a couple of years. And in January, we decided to launch the Pig Exchange Network, which is pigexchangenet.org. So you'll be able to see a little bit about it on that website. And we really, you know, we don't want to tread on anyone's toes. There's people like the AHDB and the Rare Breed Survival Trust who are all doing great work in knowledge exchange and promotion and training and all that good stuff. We just wanted to add to that pantheon of good stuff and try and target the smaller scale producers, really. You know, people with fewer than 100 sows, let's say, perhaps not well catered for at the moment. You know, not seen as a big commercial undertaking in terms of the National Pig Association or something like that, and the national herd, but they're doing a really important job in terms of the rural economy, small supply chains, local supply chains, all of that sort of stuff. And they're the people who I think are being left out of this and perhaps not supported as well. So we started the Pig Exchange Network to try and fill that gap.
Just a little more about our primary sponsor, A-Plan Rural. They provide bespoke insurance cover for farms and estates. This could be for anything from tractors and machinery to a new exciting diversification venture. So for more information, visit aplan.co.uk/rural. That's aplan.co.uk/rural.
Okay. Oh gosh, I'm conscious of time. There's so much more that we could say, but I do want to really focus more on the data side. And I mean, genetic diversity in many ways has been central to this whole conversation and mapping, understanding that diversity for the longer term. But just going back to the IT side of your career, the IT side of what you do, and specifically on data, and this is a perfect time to plug the Rural Business Focus podcast episode, which a few weeks ago we were talking with a couple of others about the future of digital in the rural sector. But this is obviously a big part of your life and what you do, and I think this is a big part of sort of what you're currently giving the sector as well, on a personal basis. In terms of the genetic diversity side, I suppose, first of all, I'm gonna split this into two parts. Why do you think is that a focus in terms of understanding that diversity? Why is focusing on that so important? But also, where do you see this going over the next 10 years?
I mean, genetic diversity as a principle is in terms of its prominence, it's not really in the local agricultural vocab. Not much. People talk about genetics pretty loosely, and what they mean is, you know, there's been some selective breeding and they've got some performance traits that they think they've either bred in or they've bred out. But really, you know, farmers and producers don't often talk about genetic diversity. But from a global level, it's part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So again, I don't know how many people know about the UN Sustainable Development Goals, but there's a whole bunch of them. And Sustainable Development Goal 2 is End Hunger, which is quite a cool one. And that's a global goal. And within each goal, there's a bunch of targets. So target 2.5, so that sits under goal 2, it is preserve native genetic diversity in plants and animals. So we've got this very lofty goal of ending hunger, and the UN recognised that preserving genetic diversity in plants and animals is a key target to that goal. So globally, it's a pretty important measure, but you know, locally and nationally, we don't talk about it a lot. I mean, broadly speaking, you've kind of got two ends of a scale, I guess, in animal production. You've got stuff that's almost wild, that has no selective breeding going on in it, and it's unmanaged breeding, if you like, and you get the random breeding properties, random genetic diversity that nature gives you. The other end of the scale would be something like a Holstein cow, where it's basically a clone, because it's been selectively bred, it's been line bred so often and from such a narrow pool that pretty much all the cows have got the same genetics. So there's a whole bunch of things that exist between those two scales. Those are really the extremes. But if you have something that's akin to a clone, that you've got a whole population of animals that have basically got the same genetics, if there's a genetic susceptibility within that animal for anything, it could be poor feet, as we see with dairy cattle, or it could be susceptibility to a disease, then all of a sudden the entire population is at risk when that risk factor enters play. You know, we've got the very human example of COVID hot on our heels, obviously. You know, it's very easy to imagine that there'd be a global pandemic affecting dairy stock in a similar sort of way, because they're so related, because there's so little diversity. And the protection against that really is genetic diversity within national herds. I mean, I think it's changing, and I'm not a sort of dairy industry focused person a lot of the time, but there are people who are folding in Jersey genetics to their Holstein herds, and all of these sorts of things are going on because that the importance of diversity has been recognized at that level. But ultimately, if we needed to breed our way out of a disease susceptibility problem, we're going to have to pull back to some of the hardiest native genetics that we've got. So, you know, we may find that, you know, the Highland cow is highly resistant to, you know, whatever disease is affecting the national dairy herd. So then, you know, we've got to try and find a way of crossing in some of that genetics to give us some protection against whatever this imaginary disease is. And that's only possible whilst you've preserved the Highland cow stock, but also preserve the genetic diversity within that breed. So you get these sort of nested concerns around genetic diversity. And really, it's not been high enough on the radar nationally for us. There are groups in Europe that have done a lot around gene banking and embryo banking, some of the native genetics. We've not done so much of that in the UK. We're quite good with seeds and with plants, and we have the Kew Gardens, ARC, and those sorts of places where we're pretty world-leading, actually, when it comes to plant genetics and preserving those. Not so with livestock. So, you know, we would have lost the old English goat genetics that we had we not achieved RBST recognition in 2020. They would have died out within a few years, I'm almost certain, or at least been so genetically unviable that they would have had to have been across with a bunch of other things. We have been on the brink of that with a bunch of equine species, with sheep, with a breed, sorry, with sheep, with goats. So to get to these desperate points that we get to with our native genetics, whilst the UN is recognising that they are the only way we have to pivot ourselves out of danger, it's a really bizarre dichotomy that we've got going on. Really, the Rare Breed Survival Trust are probably, between the 70s and now, have been the only organisation nationally that I'd say had put a lot of focus into raising the priority of genetic diversity, or at least the preservation of native breeds. We have had a FANGA, which is a committee within DEFRA, which has changed its acronym to UKGLE, but I won't bore you with those. But there is a committee within DEFRA that's responsible for reporting how well we're doing with preserving native genetic resource back to the UN. So that's all going on. But you could ask almost any farmer about this stuff, and they wouldn't know about FANGA and UKGLE, and genetic diversity doesn't really play into your day-to-day performance concerns. You know, if you're trying to make a profit from sheep farming, you're probably not really concerned day-to-day with how genetically diverse the breed is that you're using. Mm-hmm. You just want them to be performant. You know, they want to have good feet, be able to raise twins on very little feed and produce fat lambs within 6 months. And that's really all you care about. But there needs to be another layer of thought to that and another layer of, I guess, administration as much as anything else, to make sure that nationally we have not tuned all of our, let's say Breton or Kilchiviots to, you know, a high feed ration and twin and triplet producing stock in case we need to pivot away from that style of farming or in case we need to introduce some disease resistance later on. So it becomes very complicated to talk about in terms of production. But I always think of it as the farmer should perhaps have, or ideally would perhaps have, three considerations when they're choosing breeding stock and making breeding decisions. They would have the performance data focus that a lot of the farm management software gives them these days. So, you know, good feet, good health, long life, raises twin, all that sort of stuff. Then they would have the genetic diversity consideration. So what's the best breeding match within that performance pool to preserve genetic diversity? And then there's the farmer eye thing that you're never going to automate, I hope, where, you know, they just know through experience that, you know, that sheep, data aside, is going to do a better job on this ground in this system than you know, the other sheep. So it's not about the genetic diversity considerations overriding the production values or anything else. It's about what we wanted to do with the software was give breeders another tool, basically give them access to a tool that they didn't have before to make sure that they could prioritize that genetic diversity concern.
Fascinating food for thought then, I'm sure, for listeners. We're going to have to start to round this up. So I'm going to ask you the same two questions that everyone gets asked at the end of the show. And first is, what is your message for the public?
Message for the public, I think I'd like to keep simple. Where you can, and recognizing it's not possible for everybody, ditch supermarkets. Just take supermarkets out of your life. That will help farmers.
That's one of the more radical messages we've had recently. And finally, Adam, your message for farmers.
My message for farmers, I guess, playing on the data concerns, I suppose there's been a lot of messages I've heard on in conferences and on webinars and that sort of stuff where people are really putting the fear of God into farmers about, you know, don't let your data off the farm and be aware who's making money out of your data. And these are all true and valid concerns, but I wanted to give a slightly different spin on it. And I think what farmers could be doing is really thinking about their data and thinking about what they can do with their data. There's always going to be an element of your data has really no value to a big producer individually. It's only the aggregation of that data that becomes valuable. So you can't withhold your data from Red Tractor and say, pay me 100 quid for it. You know, it's not valuable until it's aggregated. But there is data that you have on farm, and there are data that your neighbours and fellow producers have on farm that is valuable to you and your business, and at quite a small scale has value to it. So if you can think more closely about the data that you're gathering, how you're using it, and perhaps collaborate more with your neighbours and fellow producers, you can leverage that data in similar and maybe better ways than the big supply chain people are using that data. So it's not necessarily about withholding it. It's about making sure that you're making use of it as well as they are.
Hmm. And your recommendation for a blog, podcast, or social media account to follow, and that can be farming or non-farming?
I thought about this a bit. One I like to recommend is John Richardson and the Future Noughts. I've been into for a few years. It's obviously John Richardson is the TV comedian, and the Future Noughts are sort of, they brand themselves as sort of systems thinkers, which, you know, is very trendy now. And they basically hour long podcasts where they discuss a single really big topic, like the future of the environment or the future of leadership, or, you know, things like that. But there's it's a great broad sweep across some really big subjects that are affecting us all at the moment without getting too in depth and without requiring a lot of specialist knowledge. So, you know, I really recommend that one.
Yeah, that sounds a really good one. I haven't come across that. Thanks for that plug. Adam, thank you so much for coming on Meet the Farmers. Thank you so much for joining me for another podcast. It's I think your story right the way through from getting into the industry to your clearly fantastic knowledge when it comes to data and the future of data and how we can utilize it better in the industry as well is truly valuable. So thank you so much for coming on and giving us your thoughts.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
That is it for today. We're going to leave it there. If you haven't already, please like and subscribe to the show wherever you're listening. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Next week, we're heading over the Irish Sea, and I'll be joined by Irish dairy farmer Bruce Thompson. And on the Rural Business Focus podcast this week, I'm interviewing my first Olympian. British skier and presenter of Ski Sunday, Shemi Alcott, will be with me on the show. Thanks again to Adam for today and to our primary podcast sponsor, A-Plant Rural Insurance, for supporting the show. Please see the show notes for more information and for any links mentioned today. For now, though, I'm Ben Eagle. This has been Meet the Farmers. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll have a great week.